Order, then clerk will call the roll.
Barker. Barnhart. Barnhart Berger. Berger Beyer. Beyer Bonamici. Boone. Boone Boquist. Boquist Bruin. Bruin Buckley. Buckley Burley. Butler. Butler Cameron. Cameron Cannon. Cannon Clem. Cowan. Dallum. Dallum Dingfelder. Dingfelder Chris Edwards. Chris Edwards David Edwards. David Edwards Esquivel. Esquivel Flores. Flores Galizio. Galizio Gerard. Gerard Gelzer. Gelzer Gilliam. Gilman. Gilman Gerard. Greenlick. Greenlick Hannah. Holvey. Holvey Hunt. Jensen. Jensen Comp. Kotek. Kotek Krieger. Krieger Crummel. Lim. Lim McPherson. Maurer. Maurer Minnis. Minnis Morgan. Morgan Nathanson. Nathanson Nelson. Nelson Nolan. Olson. Reed. Richardson. Riley. Riley Roblin. Roblin Rosenbaum. Schaffler. Schaffler Scott. Scott Shields. Greg Smith. Greg Smith Patty Smith. Patty Smith Thatcher. Tomei. Wisnet. Witt. Mr. Speaker. Not answering. Barnhart. Beyer. Boone. Boquist. Bruin. Buckley. Butler. Cameron. Dallum. Dingfelder. Chris Edwards. David Edwards. Esquivel. Flores. Galizio. Gelzer. Gilman. Greenlick. Holvey. Jensen. Kotek. Lim. Maurer. Minnis. Morgan. Nathanson. Nelson. Riley. Schaffler. Greg Smith. Patty Smith. Excused. Scott. Excused for businesses of the house. Krieger. Colleagues, when we recessed, we were under a third reading of House bills. This request to go to courtesies first, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Request to return to courtesies. We're there.
Representative Buckley asks for unanimous consent to go to courtesies. Is there an objection? Hearing none, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I would like to ask you to help me welcome Susan Baird's 7th and 8th grade social studies class from Ashland Middle School from my district. They're up in the gallery behind us. They braved the snow down in Ashland this morning to make the trek to Salem. They spent the afternoon touring the Capitol and meeting local legislators. Susan has been a wonderful teacher at Ashland Middle School for a number of years, and she's seen a plethora of successful students pass through her classroom. Many Ashland families have benefited from her teaching, including both my staff's family and my own. I would hope that you join me in thanking Susan for her service and welcome both her and her class to the Capitol today. Welcome, Susan. Welcome, students from Ashland. Thanks for being here.
It's wonderful to have you here, and I'm so glad we have an afternoon session for you to come in and observe. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to introduce to my colleagues here and ask that you extend to the courtesies of the House Dr. Michael Garland, who's on the side rail here. Mike was one of my great friends and deputy chair of the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine for the 10 years I was chair, is a philosopher, and has been the leader for Oregon Health Decisions and was very much involved in establishing the Oregon Health Plan. Mike, I welcome you, and I hope my colleagues share that. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Welcome to the Oregon House. Are there further courtesies? Special order of business. Clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 2082 relating to election petitions and declaring an emergency.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2082A. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I bring you House Bill 2082A from the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules. We call this bill the Initiative Reform and Modernization Act, or fondly IRMA, and it's a comprehensive bill intended to restore credibility to our initiative process. I want to make it clear that this is not aimed at taking away the initiative process in any way. It's simply trying to restore its credibility and integrity. The bill will reduce fraud, increase voter control, lower costs, and make sure that the will of the voters who passed ballot measure 26 prohibiting paying by the signature when signature gathering is upheld. Our committee heard from a variety of perspectives during our public hearings, and we incorporated many of these suggestions and concerns into the bill. At the end of that process, we emerged with a bill that serves the twin goals of protecting the initiative process from fraud and abuse and increasing citizens' access to that process. We need to bring Oregon's initiative system up to date. During committee hearings, we found that the system faces new threats like identity theft, so the bill places a ban on paid signature gathering for 5 years after a conviction for fraud, forgery, or identity theft. We also found that we have access to new tools like the statewide voter database and the Internet, so we deleted the old provision requiring that signatures be separated by county and created an electronic signature form that allows people to print a copy of the petition and then add their own signature to it. This simple update alone will doubtless save many voters' valid signatures from being thrown out. We wanted to ensure that regulators have good modern tools to enforce Oregon law, especially the Initiative Integrity Act and its ban on paying by the signature. So the bill requires campaigns to maintain adequate payroll records. A law, even when approved by a majority of Oregon voters, and this initiative was approved overwhelmingly, means very little if it cannot be enforced. House Bill 2082A will ensure that Oregon has the ability to nimbly and effectively control those who are currently flaunting the rules. The bill makes signature gatherers accountable to citizens. Currently, if a voter sees fraud or forgery happening in signature gathering, he or she cannot identify who it is that committed the act. So this bill creates a registration program for paid signature gatherers who will have an identifying badge so voters can identify the person who is misleading them. And because there was a Supreme Court case on similar provisions to this bill, we worked within those confines to ensure that these provisions are within constitutional restrictions. While increasing the accountability in the initiative system, House Bill 2082 will also make the Oregon ballot more accessible for small-dollar and volunteer campaigns. Volunteers play a critical role in qualifying for the ballot, and current laws can be confusing, and training volunteers is time-consuming and costly. So under this bill, the Secretary of State will provide free training to signature gatherers, reducing mistakes and raising validity rates to ensure all voters' signatures are counted. And the bill also creates an easy-to-use electronic form that any voter can print, sign, and submit on his or her own. During our hearings, we began to realize the extent to which ballot title shopping has become a real problem, and this is the practice of filing numerous versions of the same measure simply in order to get a different ballot title. There's currently a very low bar to apply for a ballot title, which has led to these multiple applications. I want to be clear about the impact of this form of abuse. Some campaigns are using taxpayer dollars to market their test political slogans. So the Initiative Reform and Modernization Act addresses this problem by increasing the number of signatures required to receive a ballot title and thereby saving our state money and resources. House Bill 2082A will bring our initiative system up to date and provide better protections against abuse. And by doing so, it will strengthen and improve our time-honored citizen initiative process. I urge you to vote yes on House Bill 2082, and I look forward to your questions.
Further discussion, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I rise in favor of this bill. I first want to say commend the committee chair in this committee. When this bill first came, I had a lot of concerns. It was a very systematic approach to looking at all of the stuff that we're doing in the initiative reform area. And I had some concerns, and we worked this bill. There were a lot of amendments that came to this bill. All of my issues were addressed throughout the testimony. And I guess the things that clearly make this an important bill, I think, for the state, she addressed earlier, but I want to make sure that people really understand. The issue about fraud and the ability of a person who is a gathering signatures to ask for your identification and do things and therefore steal that is a real, real issue with a lot of my senior constituents who get concerned about identity theft. This bill makes it clear that those people who have been convicted of those crimes will not be circulating petitions and asking for your personal information. The other part is the ability to work with the people writing the getting the petition ready to go, and having, instead of them sending in a form and then having the state secretary of state look at it and send it back and say no, you have to revise it, and back and forth and back and forth, they actually have the secretary of state with their help design it so it's all right the first time, and it gets out on the street much quicker. I think that's a really big improvement. The other one is the e-petition. To be able to send a petition out to someone and then have them sign it and send it back. And we're working on that being a one-page document that can go out and come back. And I am excited about the possibility of people using that facility, the Internet, to get information out to people, copy off the page, and send it back in. Finally, one of the issues that I've always had, and I have to admit I have not been one that's gathered a lot of signatures, but it was very frustrating to me when I would go and gather signatures and find out that I just collected a signature from a person in a house that I went to thinking they lived in my county.
Representative Roblin,
yes.
Just a moment. Colleagues, if we could please keep the chatter down a little bit, or if you'd like to carry on your conversation, could you please take it outside? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The issue of a relative visiting and they come and they say, oh, that's a really a great bill, and they sign also, and then you get home and you look at it and you realize they're from a different county and they're on this sheet and they shouldn't have been there. I've got to get rid of that signature. And they really wanted to be for that bill. With, as she explained, the electronic voter ID we have now, that's no longer necessary. This bill is necessary to make sure that from now on, if you are a registered voter in the state, you can sign that petition and it works. So for all of those reasons, all the work that was put into this during the committee time, I strongly urge an aye vote on this bill. Thank you very much.
Further discussion, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I too rise in support of House Bill 2082. I also salute the chair of our Election Rules Committee and her staff for all the work put in on this. In a nutshell, we are attempting to try to support grassroots efforts to the initiative process while making sure we focus on the paid signature gathering industry to make sure that industry runs their business in a clean way that keeps the integrity of the initiative system intact. As you know, the initiative and referendum have been a part of Oregon's democracy for over 100 years. And House Bill 2082 in no way attempts to remove this tool from the hands of the citizens. It attempts to strengthen grassroots democracy and to focus on the industry that's hijacked in many ways the initiative process. As the chair mentioned, the people of Oregon have already expressed their support for the regulation of this industry, having prohibited the payment of signature gatherers by the signature with the passage of Ballot Measure 26 in 2002. Some of these provisions of our bill have already been mentioned, but just to make sure they're clear, we will, under this bill, we're going to require paid signature gatherers to know the laws of our state. It seems like a very simple thing, but when you have signature gatherers coming into our state from other states in order to make money in the final push to get signatures, oftentimes they honestly don't know the laws they need to follow in gathering signatures. With House Bill 2082, paid signature gatherers will be required to watch a short training video through the internet on a DVD on the laws that our state has with signature gathering. House Bill 2082 is going to require paid signature gatherers to also register with the Secretary of State so we know who we're dealing with in this industry. This bill will also end the complicated process, as Representative Roblin said, of the signature sheet templates being developed. And it will require chief petitioners using paid signature gatherers to maintain payroll records for review by the Secretary of State, the Attorney General, and the Bureau of Labor and Industry. This will also require chief petitioners for initiative campaigns to report contribution and expenditure information, just as you and I have to do with our candidate campaigns. House Bill 2082 does not hinder grassroots efforts. In my opinion, it strengthens grassroots efforts. It prevents abuses of our democratic process by the paid signature gathering industry. It's a step forward. It's not the last step we're going to have to take on the initiative process, but it's an excellent step forward, and I highly urge your yes vote. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Mr. Speaker, this morning I noticed, with all the questions to the representative from Wilsonville, that my colleagues have a lot of time on their hands, so I wanted to recommend a book that's related to this. There's a great book on the initiative system by Dr. Richard Ellis, who's a professor of politics at Willamette University. So I know people are looking for something to read with all the free time, so I'd suggest that. Now that I've got your attention, I hope. For much of the 20th century, the initiative and reform process or system was widely called the Oregon system. While South Dakota was the first state to adopt the initiative and referendum, the first initiative elections in the United States were actually right here in Oregon. No other state in the Union has had more initiatives on the ballot than Oregon. So obviously this is a tremendously important issue, and I too wanted to compliment the chair for her great work in the committee. While the populist pioneers of the initiative and referendum, the William Urens and Robert Hares, would be gratified that direct democracy was thriving 120 years after its inception in some 24 states in the Union, I really believe that they would be troubled, colleagues, by the initiative industrial complex that has emerged in the past few decades. So while for some people the initiative and referendum system represents really grassroots direct democracy, kind of a vehicle to circumvent a stalled state legislature, for others, the initiative system has primarily become a way to generate profit. And for too many bad actors, Oregon's liberal initiative laws have become an invitation for fraudulent activities. This initiative industrial complex, and I can't take credit for that term, but I think it's a good one, has resulted in an increasing number of initiatives that are bankrolled by wealthy, out-of-state interests and individuals. In fact, in the 2006 election, or campaign, 5 out of the 10 ballot measures were funded almost entirely from out-of-state individuals or groups. So Oregon has become really kind of a guinea pig for what I would call greenbacks democracy, not grassroots democracy. So the Oregon editorial board, the Oregonian editorial board, wrote last year, and I quote, "They sit in offices in Illinois, New York, Nevada, and Washington, D.C., watching at a comfortable distance the million-dollar lab experiments they are sponsoring in Oregon," unquote. So these groups have, they really have little interest in following Oregon's signature-gathering laws. And as we saw last summer, national companies and their subcontractors create elaborate payment schemes to make it appear that they're following the ban that the voters of Oregon passed on per signature payment. But then they go in sort of in plain sight and they pass out cash for signatures on street corners. So House Bill 2082 will provide the Secretary of State, the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and the Oregon Attorney General with the means to detect and stop the fraud as it occurs. So when voters passed Measure 26, the ban on payment per signatures, I think they sent a strong message to this body that they want to sustain and protect the initiative system, and that's what this bill does. Unfortunately, some of the campaigns that we've seen recently have spent as much time trying to get around the system that we've created as they have in circulating positions. So House Bill 2082 will give the Secretary of State's office the means to hold these renegade chief petitioners accountable while opening up the initiative process for the dedicated citizen activists who represent true grassroots democracy. So I think this bill is about mending, it's kind of mend it, not end it. Let's keep the initiative system strong, and I think 2082 does that, and I urge your aye vote.
Further discussion, Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Many of you know over the
to the bill.
In the last to the bill, please. Many of you know over the last interim, I ran an initiative campaign to put the right to health care in the Oregon Constitution. It gave me first-hand experience at how complex and difficult it was for a citizen group to try and achieve an outcome. If I'd had $500,000 in the bank in advance, it would have been simple, and we would have gotten done. But we didn't, and much of the campaign was run as a mom and pop operation, with me being the pop and Harriet being the mom, and processing virtually every single form that came through the campaign. Under the current statutes, we would have required about 140,000 signatures to get the 100,846 valid signatures we needed to put it on the ballot last November. And we ended up, for a variety of reasons, not being able to do that. We gathered just under 120,000 signatures instead of 140 or 145,000. But because of the craziness of the laws, we ended up with less than 90,000 valid signatures out of the 120,000 signatures we gathered. And the common kinds of problems we had was one of our volunteers would be out in downtown Portland and would gather six signatures from Multnomah County, three from Washington County, and one from Clackamas County. And the three from Washington County and the one from Clackamas County would be thrown out because the requirement was that every signature on a single sheet of 10 be from the same county, because the statute required the county clerks to validate the signatures, and therefore you needed to be able to separate it by county. You needed to hand number them by county, which was a process Harriet and I did. We had volunteers to help us, but we hand numbered them by county and then sent them into the Secretary of State's office. We also had them excluded for a variety of other arcane reasons. For example, we sent out 300,000 signature sheets. 200,000 signature sheets to people asking them to sign it themselves or sign it themselves and their spouse and send it back in, but make sure you sign it twice. Make sure you sign it on the line and make sure you sign it as having witnessed your own signature. That turned out to be very difficult to get through to people, and nearly 40% of the signatures we got had the signature on the line but didn't have the signature on the bottom as having witnessed their own signature. So we ended up putting a 39-cent stamp on it, sending it back, and trying to get them back because we knew we had somebody who was willing to sign. It was a nightmare. I had a bill in this session to straighten out some of these problems, but I was delighted when the Rules, Elections, and Ethics Committee started working on this omnibus bill. And this bill is an extraordinary improvement. The e-signature page, for example, allows anybody to download one signature. I mean, download a sheet, has one signature on it. They don't have to witness their own signature. They just sign the thing and mail it back in. And they download two of them for they and their spouse or their partner. Or if they have three kids, they download five of them and send five of them back in an envelope. It's got this crazy county business off. And what this will do is really improve the possibility of grassroots citizen organizations being able to get a measure on the ballot. It really simplifies the rules in so many ways. I urge you to join me and support this bill. Thank you.
Further discussion. Representative Garrod.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I apologize if some of you have heard this story. To the bill. My district's a little different than many of yours, especially if you have an urban district. Walking in my district takes on a whole new tone. You knock on the door, somebody walks, opens it up, and if they see that you're a political figure or you're involved with the legislature, it usually gets slammed in your face. So that happened about three times, and they were from ours. That should have been my votes, and they probably were. Finally, at the top of my lungs, the third time happened, I said, I have the NRA endorsement. And the guy opens the door back up, and he says, why didn't you say that to start with? And we went on about various things. But that was important enough for him to reopen the door. The point of the story is, in my district, people hate the legislature. They don't trust it. The best thing we could do is have signy die and opening day ceremonies on the same day. Now, if you look at the initiative process, and where this comes into this bill is, the initiative process is the counterweight to the legislature. They feel that they have a right to the initiative process. And a couple things here really bother me. And I got to tell you, like Representative Greenlick, I'm going to be putting out a ballot measure after the session's over, and I know firsthand what you have to go through, and it's not fun. There was a lot of things brought out about shopping for ballot titles. Well, this is you have people in charge of various groups that determine the ballot title that are partisan, and that's just the way the system is. I don't have a problem with that, but if you get a bad ballot title, you are not going to go anywhere. That's just a simple fact. So you go until you get something that actually gives you a chance of winning. It's very, very difficult to get all the signatures, comply with all the rules, but the one thing that really has me angered on this bill is the requirement for financial records or payroll records to be reviewed by who? Boley. Now, if Boley's not partisan, I don't know who is for an organization. And the last thing I want is Boley involved in the election process. I think that's a travesty, and I'm voting no.
Further discussion, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have a couple of questions for the carrier.
One question to the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I will.
She does.
Thank you, Representative. On page 4, at line 12, starting at line 12, at the end of that line, it says the accounts shall be as current as of not later than the seventh calendar day after the date a payment is made to a person for obtaining signatures on the petition. This has to do with paying petition initiative signature gatherers. Is this the same language that's currently in employment law in general, or is this going to be new language as it relates to specific employees of signature gatherers?
Just a moment, please. Thank you, Representative. It is specific to signature gathering.
Follow up?
Further question to the carrier? Does the carrier yield?
I will.
Thank you.
She does.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. So this will be setting a new precedent in Oregon law as far as employment law is concerned, correct? I'm just clarifying what you just said.
Representative, I think, though I'm not a labor lawyer, that under employment law currently, people have to be paid even more promptly than this, and you would, if there were a challenge or a complaint, I think you would have to have records that indicated that you had done so. So I'm not sure that this would be much stricter, but it is a different requirement.
Thank you. Further question?
Further question to the carrier. Does the carrier yield? She does.
Thank you, Representative. On page 29, section 31, section 1A and section 1B appear to be contradictory to each other. Can you help me understand how those are not contradictory to each other?
Clarification, please.
Clarification?
Could you please be a little more specific in your question?
Well, it says that, thank you, Mr. Speaker and Representative, it says that Section 2 of this 2007 Act does not apply to persons who pay or receive money or other valuable consideration for obtaining signatures of electors on a state initiative or referendum petition that, if filed with the required number of signatures of electors, will be submitted to the people at the general election held on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November 2008. So it has to do with the election, the next general election. In Section B, it says Section 2 of this 2007 Act applies to persons who pay or receive money or other valuable consideration for obtaining signatures of electors on a state initiative or referendum petition that, if filed with the required number of signatures of electors, will be submitted to the people at a general election occurring after the first Tuesday, after the first Monday in November 2008, regardless of when the prospective petition for the initiative or referendum petition is filed. That appears to be a conflict to me.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And Representative, I think that I do understand what you're asking. And this, the difference between those two sections is that this, these changes will not be effective for the current election cycle. So if, you know, campaigns are underway right now or, you know, for November, this coming election, these changes, although the Secretary of State will begin to set up a process, you won't have to require, you won't be required to follow all these guidelines. But for all campaigns, regardless of when an initiative is filed, all campaigns for the next election cycle, then you will be required to abide by these guidelines. And the reason for that is because a lot of initiatives have already been filed for the next election. And we didn't think that it was fair to some campaigns to have initiatives where they had gotten a lot of their signatures under the old rules, and then we had the rules changed in midstream, or other campaigns that were for the same cycle having to follow a different set of rules. And I think if you look at the language on line 38, where it says, after the first Tuesday, after the first Monday in November 2008, that section actually indicates that it's not the current cycle, but the ones that follow after that.
Further question, Mr. Speaker?
Question to the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
She does.
Thank you, Representative. So would that be the same situation then with starting on line 41 of C of section 1A, or excuse me, section 31 sub 1 sub C, and then section 31 subsection 2 A?
Which one is recall? 2A.
He's looking at. I thought he was looking at. Oh, yeah. Okay. Thank you, Representative. I think the first section that you read from or were referring to actually refers to recall petitions.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other section refers to. Yeah, initiative petitions that have already been filed for 2008.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. To the bill?
To the bill.
Well, just for a little background and factoids, Oregon was one of the first states, if not the first state, to enact the initiative process. That was back in 1902. And just sort of interesting is back in 1912, there were 28 ballot measures, including mostly initiatives on the ballot. 28. There have been concerns that we've been submitting too many ballot initiatives. Well, back in 1910, 1912, they were approaching 30, 26, 28 ballot initiatives. Now, I do believe there are some positive aspects to the bill, but in my opinion, the negatives outweigh the positive. In committee testimony on this bill, we heard from a variety of testimony and people and groups on this bill. What struck me was the diversity of the groups opposing this bill or opposing efforts that would hinder the people's initiative rights. Oregonians in Action, the Taxpayer Coalition, Dan Meek, Crime Victims United, the Oregon Education Coalition, Oregonians for Affordable Health Care, Water for Life, the Independent and Green Parties, the Parent Education Association, the list goes on and on. And if you haven't had the opportunity yet today to raise your eyebrows, I would like to draw attention to a floor letter that was delivered to your desks this morning on my behalf from OSPIRC, not an alliance you would normally see. But let me just highlight a couple of the points raised in the letter by OSPIRC. First, the requirement to round up 1,000 signatures before you can even get a ballot title isn't going to stop big money campaigns, but it might stop the little people, the grassroots, the volunteers just wanting to get something before the voters. And second, there are additional paperwork requirements for citizen petitioners that even the highest paid lobbyist in this building doesn't have to comply with. Finally, there's a very serious constitutional problem here regarding all the hoops petitioners have to jump through in order to circulate an initiative for signature. There's registration, you got photographs, a bunch of training, signed statement that you have read and understood Oregon law. Well, it's my opinion that Oregonians should not have to get permission from their government before they exercise their First Amendment right to free speech. The people who are engaged in exercising the right of the people to petition for action and change, the people who use Oregon's historic and progressive initiative and referendum process spoke to our committee, and they asked us, actually, they begged us, don't do this. But here we are, and it begs the question, why are we doing this? And as I consider the testimony we heard in committee, I'm left to conclude that we're doing this because there's a segment of our political culture that just simply doesn't like what the people pass when given the chance. Frankly, about half the time, neither do I. But I will support their right to do so. And I believe that the process of citizen involvement should be made easier, not more difficult. House Bill 2082 puts more of the burdens on those taking matters to the people, and in my opinion, that is wrong. Let's understand why the people exercise this right. They do it when we refuse to do what the people demand of us, or we go ahead and do something they've asked us not to. And now we are adding regulations to frustrate the ability of the voters to correct our own inadequacies. And to me, it just seems a little presumptuous, if not a little arrogant, to do that on our part. And we should be making the people's voice easier to be heard and not more difficult. And for that reason, I respectfully urge your no vote.
Further discussion, Representative Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And the carrier yield for a couple of questions.
Question of the carrier, does the carrier yield?
Yes, I do.
She
Thank
does.
You, the representative. As I read the bill, I couldn't find out the age limitation. Can you verify that? Is there any limitations on age gathering the signatures?
Thank you for that question, Representative, and thank you very much for getting me these questions ahead of time. And no, you did not miss anything. There is not an age specified in the bill, and nor is there a requirement that the signature gatherer even be a registered voter.
The follow-up questions?
Another question to the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
She does.
Okay. Thank you very much again. In case 9, 10, 12, even they are not even teenagers, if they are gathering the signatures, then are they committing the labor laws in our state?
I'm not sure I understand your question,
okay.
Representative.
Since they are minors, since there is no age limitation, minors might go out door-to-door gathering signatures after certain training, according to this plan. Since they are paid, are they subject to the Oregon labor law?
Yes, Representative. If they are being paid, they would be employees, and therefore they would be subject to the same labor laws as any other employees or minors would be.
Follow up the questions.
Further questions, carrier yield.
I do.
The next logical questions. So if they are not paid, then they are okay.
Yes, Representative, if they are volunteers, then most of these changes that we have described in this bill do not even apply to them anyway. And obviously, they're not employees if they're not being paid, so labor law wouldn't apply to them either.
Okay. Another question?
Further questions, is Carrie Yield. She does.
I do.
Thank you very much again. The page 2, I believe it's page 1. I believe this is page 2, section 7 through 19. The statement signed by the chief petitioner of each petition upon which the applicant will gather signatures. And I'm sure you know that. And then the question is, how do we know that gathering the signatures, the person, if they are convicted of felon or not? How do we enforce that?
Representative, the registration process specified in this bill requires each applicant for a registration to certify that they have not been convicted of any of the identity or fraud crimes specified in the last 5 years. To have done a background check would have been prohibitively expensive, and so we are relying on people to tell the truth. Obviously, some might not, and that would have to be dealt with later, but right now the bill, right now there's no requirement. I mean, you could have been convicted of any crime whatsoever very recently, and you could be out there getting people's signatures and using them, and there have been cases of this that were brought to our attention. So this is a requirement to at least have people certified that they haven't been convicted of those crimes.
Follow-up questions?
Follow-up question, does the carrier yield?
I do.
She does.
Since this bill requires at least last 5 years, if the person has been convicted or not, that the process it, when someone applied as a signed petitioner, then the Secretary of State has 2 days to issue the license, issue the certificate. The person can go out, gather the signatures. Within 2 days, the Secretary of State has to verify this person, whether the person has the conviction or not in the 5 years. Do they have that fund and that available resources to do that?
Representative, the bill does require that the Secretary of State process the application and get back to the person applying within 2 days, and that is so it would not be an onerous requirement that people have to wait too long before being able to collect signatures. The bill, however, does not require the Secretary of State to do a background check.
Okay. Another question?
Further question, does Carrier yield?
I do.
She does.
All right. Thank you very much again. And as I read the bill, when someone gathering the signatures are not, didn't get the proper training and the license of the certificate, any signature gathered is invalidated according to the bill. Am I saying correctly? Do you follow what I'm trying to say?
Yes, Representative, if a paid petitioner fails to register, then they are not allowed to be out collecting signatures at all. So if they did collect signatures, they'd be doing so fraudulently, and those signatures would not be considered valid.
Okay, that's leading to another question, Mr.
Another question? Does the carrier yield?
I do.
Okay, if someone got the proper training and the certificate from the Secretary of State, and then after a month or 2 months, the person found to be a convicted felon, then what that happened, the signature he gathered already?
Representative, I actually don't know the answer to that question. I know for sure that if they were found to have been convicted, then their registration would be invalidated and they would no longer be eligible to collect signatures. I do know that the Secretary of State makes every effort to count signatures, not to throw them out. And so I think this would have to be a question posed to the Secretary of State. It did not come up in our hearings.
Okay, thank you. Another question, please.
Another question to the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
Okay, it is confusing to me. Page 3, line 507, and that the paid petitioner and volunteers, they carry two different colors. And why they require two different colors?
Representative, the reason there are two different colors, and this is something that really came out of much of the testimony, is that right now volunteers are essentially carrying the same petition as a paid petitioner and don't really like that. They'd like to be identified as volunteers. So one color would be for volunteers, one color would be for paid petitioners, and that would make it much easier for the public as well to know whether they were dealing with a paid petitioner or a volunteer.
Okay, another question?
Yes.
Another question, the carrier does yield.
Thank you very much again. So I'm not sure if I'm a constituent, just looking at simply the color, whether the person is the volunteer or the paid person, unless it's said in there.
Right, and the petition itself would indicate what the color indicated. So, you know, basically it would say blue means volunteer, green means paid, or whatever the colors were.
Okay, just thank you very much for that. I have just one or two more questions. And the page 4...
Further question, does the carrier yield?
I do.
Thank
she
you
does.
Very much again. In page 4, line 18 through 20, and In addition to the review conducted under subsection 3 of this section, Secretary, Attorney General, or Commissioner of Bali may inspect. Why these three agencies has authority to inspect instead of one agency?
And Representative, thank you for that question. Because all of these agencies have authority right now over various aspects of this process. The Labor Commissioner has authority over the wage and hours, whether people have been correctly paid, those payroll records. The Secretary of State clearly has authority over the elections-related process. The Attorney General also has authority over the criminal aspects of this. And right now, those agencies are not able to either access records in a timely way or share information with each other. So this section specifies that they have a right to that information, which has been a problem in the past, and also have a right to share the information with each other.
Okay, I just have one more question.
Last question to the carrier.
Yes.
I do appreciate it again. In the page 4, line 33-34 says, Chief Petitioner may not obtain additional signatures on the petition until the Chief Petitioner is able to supply the account to the Secretary, Attorney General, or Commissioner. And it seems to me that they might need time to supply the account, but since they were not able to supply the account, they are stopped gathering signatures. I don't believe anyone is guilty until it's proven. Could you elaborate on that issue?
Representative, thank you for your question. And the way it will work is that the information would be requested by the appropriate authority, whether it's the Attorney General, Labor Commissioner, or Secretary of State. And they obviously have to produce that in a reasonable time frame. And they should have that information available because this law is being spelled out very clearly for them. If they refuse to comply, and I can tell you that we had a great deal of testimony that in the last election cycle, information was just not forthcoming, then there needs to be some pressure on them to provide it. That pressure is that they must cease gathering signatures simply until they've provided the information.
Thank you very much. To the bill.
To the bill.
I just want to thank the representative from the northeast, southeast of Portland for answering my questions. And as I look at the whole bill, there are some problems I see, such as even small children shall be able to gather some information, their signatures, as long as they are some proper trainings. That involves the child labor law involves in it. Maybe not, maybe. And then there's no clear line in when someone is convicted felons or not. There's no way we can verify that. And then certainly Secretary of State Office, they are not going to do that in 2 days when they apply for these jobs. Then simply they need to give the certificate to them in 2 working days. And simply Secretary Office is not equipped to do that. And so at the same time, the chief contractor is not able to verify them, whether they passed 5 years, whether they have a criminal record or not. And this is very difficult. This is unenforceable that the bill, the law we are making, and plus some other issues I have. And this will be circumventing the current system. And this, to me, look like undemocratic. And then the current system is not perfect system, but it has worked. And it has been more than 100 years it has been worked. We should leave the citizens' initiative process alone instead of we are doing it. When we are taking away more power from the people, then it will be more power to the legislators. I don't think that's the good. And so because of the reasons I have stated, I think it is a prudent approach voting no on this bill. Thank you very much.
Further discussion, Representative Hunt.
To the bill?
To the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, frankly, this bill does have a serious flaw. I don't believe this is tough enough. I don't think it goes far enough. I think we've got some serious problems with people trying to buy Oregon's initiative process. I frankly like the original version of the bill that called for a 10,000 signature threshold before you could have it certified for going forward. The kind of ballot titles, we've heard some of the numbers today about the number of initiatives that are on the ballot, but that's after they make them to the ballot. The number that are being submitted for ballot title shopping is up, and it's way up. We have at least 70 measures that have already been filed for the November 2008 election, and dozens and dozens and dozens more to come. We've got a serious problem. I think this bill has a serious flaw in that it doesn't go far enough, but it is a step in the right direction. And for that reason, I would urge you to support it. I would also remind us that the signatures that are required, whether it's the 1,000 that are listed in this bill or the 10,000 that were required under the original bill, those all count toward the final total that you have to gather. Those are not in addition to or separated from. Whether it's the 1,000 signatures in this bill or the 10,000 that I frankly think we should do and someday hopefully will do as a requirement, all those count toward the eventual total. So this bill is not tough enough, but on balance, I would urge your support.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Rosenbaum, would you care to close?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, House Bill 2082, the Initiative Reform and Modernization Act, I believe will restore integrity and strengthen Oregon's initiative process. And let me make it perfectly clear that I am a proponent of the initiative process. Not only did we have the first initiative process in the country, that it was also how women got the right to vote in this country. And I have used the initiative process myself and more than once and served as a chief petitioner as well as gathered many, many signatures. So I really, truly believe in this process. I believe in the citizens' right to go directly to the ballot, and I would never support any bill that I believed diminished those rights. I think several points have been made by speakers, and they need to be addressed. I think that it should be pointed out that already under the current system, signature sheets have been thrown out by the Secretary of State simply because they couldn't identify who was witnessing or gathering the signatures. And under this proposal with the registration, it'll be much less likely that that happens. I think that the issue of more signatures needed to get a ballot title. Well, remember, right now, to get a ballot title, you only need 25 signatures. You basically could walk around your office and get 25 signatures. The original proposal in this bill was to get 10% or 10,000 signatures in order to get a ballot title, and that was drastically reduced. So the number that's in the bill right now of 1,000 is much less than what was proposed. Likewise,
excuse
there were
me,
other
Representative Rosenbaum. Colleagues, can we please keep the chatter down? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Likewise, there were other things proposed that were totally eliminated from this bill. One in particular was that there was an original proposal that would not allow a signature gatherer to write on the petition at all. You couldn't fill in blanks. You couldn't correct things. That was so controversial that in the end we couldn't find a way to resolve it, and so we just eliminated it. I think the issue that was raised about the payroll records and the Bureau of Labor Commissioner being a partisan elected official, that's actually not a partisan office right now. Thanks to a previous labor commissioner, it's no longer partisan. And in fact, it is the labor commissioner who's charged with enforcing our wage and hours laws. So ultimately, that's where the buck stops when you're talking about anything that violates those laws. It really has to be the labor commissioner. The bill does not create new restrictions on grassroots or volunteer campaign activities. These things that we have been talking about apply to paid signature gathering, and they're really essential, I think, to restoring what voters were saying when they voted for ballot measure 26, the Initiative Integrity Act, that said that it is illegal to pay by the signature. As to the constitutionality of this bill, the case that's been referred to in Colorado simply questioned the way Colorado had structured the provisions of a registration program. It did not say that registration was per se unconstitutional, and we worked with legislative counsel and were mindful, and the Secretary of State, and were mindful of that opinion when we wrote House Bill 2082. I think that this will actually in many ways make it easier, particularly on grassroots campaigns. The elimination of the requirement to sort by counties, as has been said, will remove something that's quite onerous right now. The template requirement that gets approval up front will get petition sheets on the street faster, but ultimately, this is meant to serve the public. It's meant to restore accountability and integrity and to reduce or eliminate the fraud that was rampant during the last election cycle and well-publicized. I think the public has a right to expect a process that is fair and gives them a voice, but at the same time respects their identity, respects their confidentiality, does not have people that are criminals out there collecting and using their signatures, or in many cases just making up signatures and turning them in fraudulently. So it is my belief and my strong belief that this bill will do all of those things. I would like to thank the committee members who worked so hard on this, but even more I would like to thank the staff who did excellent work. The committee administrator, as well as my own legislative assistant, did remarkable work to bring this bill to you today. It is a good bill. I think it's workable, and I urge your aye vote. And, Mr. Speaker, I respectfully ask for a call of the House.
Representative Rosenbaum requests a call of the House. She is joined by Representative Holvey, Representative Nathanson, Representative Cannon, Representative Kotek, and Representative Reed. The doorkeepers will bar the doors, the sergeant-at-arms will attend, and the clerk will call the roll.
Barker, Barnhart, Berger, Beyer, Bonamici, Boone, Boquist, Bruin, Buckley, Burley, Butler, Cameron, Cannon, Clem, Cowan, Dallum, Dingfelder, Chris Edwards, David Edwards, Esquivel, Flores, Galizio, Garrard, Gelzer, Gilliam, Gilman, Gerard, Greenlick, Hannah, Holvey, Hunt, Jensen, Comp, Kotek, Krieger, Crummel, Lim, McPherson, Maurer, Minnis, Morgan, Nathanson, Nelson, Nolan, Olson, Reed, Richardson, Riley, Roblin, Rosenbaum, Schaffler, Scott, Shields, Greg Smith, Patty Smith, Thatcher, Tomei, Wisnet, Witt, Mr. Speaker, not answering, Mr. Speaker, excuse, not subject to the call, Krieger, Scott,
All members are present. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Crummell, how do you vote? Representative Crummell? Crummell votes no. Representative Clem, how do you vote? Clem votes aye. Representative Berger, how do you vote? Berger votes no. Representative Flores, how do you vote? Flores votes no. Representative Witt, how do you vote? Witt votes aye. Representative Maurer, how do you vote? No. Maurer votes no. House Bill 2082, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2891, relating to certification of labor organizations by the Employment Relations Board.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2891. Representative Holvey. I'll be
here. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, House Bill 2891.
Please keep it down, colleagues.
Makes only one significant change in the process for workers to choose a union and bargain for pay and benefits. It puts the choice of whether or not to proceed to bargain in the hands of the workers rather than management. No one is deprived of democracy. The bill merely moves the division into the hands of those who are eligible to form or join a union, bargain, and vote. Majority sign-up minimizes workplace conflict. This process avoids coercion and harassment of employees and eliminates some of the delays that frustrate workers' efforts to form unions. Majority sign-up is a proven approach. Many responsible major companies have found majority sign-up to be a free and fair way to assess workers' choice and resulting in less employer-employee conflict. Majority sign-up is democratic. Under majority sign-up, a union is formed only if a majority of all employees sign written authorization forms. Employees vote to have the union represent them by signing the forms. Any employee who does not sign a written authorization form is presumed not to support union representation. Majority sign-up is already 100% legal in both the public and private sector. This is not a new and radical concept. The change being proposed under House Bill 2891 is in who makes the choice. Colleagues, I urge an aye vote on this bill.
Further discussion, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier, does the carrier yield?
Yes.
He does.
Can you tell me why the process of majority sign-up or card check is not used for decertification of the union?
Yes, under current law in most state jurisdiction, the ones that adopt the NLRA case law, for example, an employer can and must withdraw recognition when a majority of workers no longer want the union to represent them. So majority sign-up is not necessary because any indication by workers, including card petition signing, the majority no longer wants a union to represent them, triggers an obligation by the employer to withdraw recognition from the union.
Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have a question. I wonder if the carrier would yield.
Question to the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
Yes.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. Is there anywhere in the bill, or was there any discussion in committee with regards to timelines for submission of the cards? Because what it appears as though is that once the union starts passing out the cards, they could wait for 30 days or 60 days or 18 years to get the appropriate number of cards back before they would have authorization to unionize.
There was no discussion in committee about a timeline. That clearly falls under the jurisdiction of the Employee Relations Board as it pertains to public employees, and I'm sure that they would follow the time. I can't speak to what they would follow, but guidelines are set out in the National Labor Relations Act, which don't cover these particular class of employees, but the Employee Relations Board has the authority to decide what that timeline would be.
Thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Chair? Or
further question to the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
Yes.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. For public employers, I'm curious about something, and that is there anywhere in the bill, I didn't see anything, but I just wanted to clarify, is there anything in the bill about removal of the gag orders so that when a union is certified but fails to deliver a demand to bargain letter, while in the press and at meetings blasting the public officials, is there anything in here that addresses that particular issue?
No, it doesn't change any of the other current laws around organizing or any of these issues.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Holby, do you wish to close?
No.
Stand at ease. Okay. Representative Cameron has some further discussion. Rep to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I guess I have a question for the carrier because I just got handed a couple of cards here.
Question to the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
Yes.
I just got handed a couple of cards. I've never seen them before, but I just wanted to ask a question. If an employer had an employee come to them with one of these cards in their hand today, would the employer be able to sit down not only with that person but call a meeting and require all their employees to come to that meeting to talk about that card?
You know, I don't know that question is germane to this particular bill. Can he give me a restate that question? I'm not really sure.
Clarification?
Sure. If an employee came to an employer today with one of these cards, which is about what this bill is about, organizing, all they have to do is fill out this card and a majority of them send these cards back. If an employee came to their employer and said, I received one of these cards in the mail today, I don't know what it's about, will you sit down and talk to me? And in fact, if the employee said, can we have a meeting with all the employees in the business to talk about what this means, under today's law with these cards, could we have that meeting?
Yeah, I don't believe that the cards you're speaking of would be mailed to an employee, first of all, and this is a different type of card that you're talking about.
I'll just withdraw my question.
Further discussion. Representative Garrod.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. A question to my favorite carrier.
Question to the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
Certainly.
This isn't a duck question. Actually, we have a little bit of confusion. I just want to make this only applies to the public sector as far as being able to unionize. Is that correct or not?
Yes, that is correct when the Employee Relations Board deals with public sector employees.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Poldy, do you wish to close?
Just briefly, Mr. Chair, or Mr. Speaker, excuse me. You know, folks, this really is a simple bill about just allowing workers to organize and to basically choose a union free of intimidation. Actually yesterday, and it was reported in the Bend area transit basically fired one of their employees for standing up in a city council meeting and urging paratransit to recognize the union that a majority of the employees voted for in January. And Evans was identified in the media, and don't know why he was fired, but he was summarily fired. And you know, employees don't really have the ability to really stand up at the workplace and say we want to join a union and not be subject to an incredible amount of pressure and oftentimes intimidation and threat of losing their job. And so this bill just basically gives them the ability to say we want to join a union, we have the majority of our folks want to join a union, and they want to be recognized. And I think this is a good bill, fair to workers. And, you know, we don't need to have our public sector employers, you know, hiring very expensive attorneys and union-busting organizations to come in and spend public tax dollars to try to stop them from doing this. I think this is a good bill. It's fair to workers, and I think it would actually save the state money. Thank you. Call of the House, please. Respectfully.
Representative Holby requests a call of the House. He is joined by Greg Smith, Representative Dahlem, Representative McPherson, Representative Barnhart, Representative Greenlick, and Representative Riley. The doorkeepers will bar the doors. The sergeant-at-arms will attend, and the clerk will call the roll.
Barker. Barnhart. Berger. Beyer. Bonamici. Boone. Boquist. Boquist Bruin. Buckley, Burley, Butler, Cameron, Cannon, Clem, Cowan, Dahlem, Dingfelder, Chris Edwards, David Edwards, Esquivel, Flores, Galizio, Garrard, Gelzer, Gilliam, Gilman, Gerard, Greenlick, Hannah, Holvey, Hunt, Jensen, Conk, Kotek, Krieger, Crummel, Lim, McPherson, Maurer, Minnis Morgan, Nathanson, Nelson, Nolan, Olson, Reed, Richardson, Riley, Roblin, Rosenbaum, Schaffler, Scott, Shields, Greg Smith, Patty Smith, Thatcher, Tomei, Wisnet, Witt, Mr. Speaker, not answering, Boquist, excuse, not subject to the call, Krieger, Scott.
All members are present. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system.
Representative Minnis, how do you vote? Minnis votes no. Representative Esquivel, how do you vote?
No.
Esquivel votes no. Representative Girard, how do you vote? Girard votes aye. Representative Crummell, how do you vote? Crummell votes no. Representative Girard, how do you vote? Girard votes aye. Representative Thatcher, how do you vote? Thatcher votes no. Representative Hanna, how do you vote? Hanna votes no. Representative Maurer, how do you vote? Maurer votes no. Representative Flores, how do you vote? Flores votes no. House Bill 2891, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2893, relating to mandatory workplace communication to employee about employee's opinions.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2893. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Bill 2893 prohibits an employer from requiring an employee to attend a meeting or participate in communication concerning the employer's opinion about religious or political matters, or from taking adverse employment action against employee related to the meeting or communication. Requires employers to post a notice regarding employees' rights related to the provision of the measure. Provides exceptions for religious organizations, political organizations, and executive meetings. Good bill should pass. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. A question to the carrier.
Question to the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
Yes, thank you.
If I put forth a hypothetical, let's say I work for Intel, and Intel calls a meeting and takes a roll call of the employees to see who's there, and then has a prayer at that meeting, would that be a violation of this bill?
Representative, if it's a condition of employment to attend that meeting, then I would have to interpret it as a yes.
Is the state legislature an employer under this?
As far as I know, I get my check every month, so yes, sir.
Would you assume that if the state legislature did something as outrageous as calling roll and then having a prayer, they will end up in violation of this bill?
Well, Representative, I may not agree with the outrageous part, but I think that may be interpreted that way, yes, sir.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Kump.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Question to the carrier.
Question of the carrier, does the carrier yield?
Yes.
He does.
Representative from Happy Valley, will House Bill 2893 prohibit employers from communicating with employees?
It will only, the way I interpret it, Madam Speaker, is this. They will not be able to communicate their political or religious opinions, force employees to sit at a meeting and mandate them to listen to their political or religious opinions as a condition of employment. They can invite them to a meeting, and they can voluntarily attend meetings and discuss those opinions, but not as a condition of employment.
Thank you, Representative. Follow-up?
Additional question?
Thank
yes.
you.
Does the carrier yield?
Yes, ma'am.
He does.
What kind of information can be mailed by an employer? Emailed, mail, either one?
An employer can email and mail anything they want as long as reading that information is not under a condition of employment.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Speaker.
Further discussion, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I wonder if the carrier would yield to a couple of questions.
Question of the carrier, does the carrier yield?
Yes, ma'am.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. In reading through the bill on page 2, lines starting at line 6 with section 2, sub 3, says an aggrieved employee may bring a civil action to enforce this section no later than 60 days after the date of the alleged violation in the circuit court of the judicial district where the violation is alleged to have occurred or where the employer has its principal office. I'm just curious as to why this is going directly into the courts and is not going to either arbitration or mediation first.
I think that just the proponents of the bill and those of us who voted for it believe that's the proper place to take your complaint.
Thank you. Further question?
Additional question. Does the carrier yield?
Yes, ma'am.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. On line 9, or starting there, it says the court may award a prevailing employee all appropriate relief, and then it goes on to talk about injunctive relief and so on and so forth. Then at line 14, it says the court shall award a prevailing employee treble damages together with reasonable attorney fees and costs.
Mm-hmm.
In a discussion that I had late last fall, with the presiding judge in Clackamas County, he was very concerned about how we give direction to the court, which is sometimes not very good because we use may instead of shall. Mm-hmm. And so we don't give them very clear direction. Is this anything that was considered in the committee discussions about this bill? And was there a discussion about changing that may to on line 9 to a shall?
No.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I have one more question.
Additional question. Does the carrier yield?
Yes, ma'am.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. This bill addresses whether or not an employer is communicating about religious or political matters. I'm just wondering, is unionization considered a political or a religious matter?
Unionization, Madam Speaker, was that the word?
Yes, that was the word.
Thank you. An employer may not, shall not, mandate any employees to sit in any meeting and listen to their opinions about anything political, which I think is union, and I believe unionization is a political question, if that meeting is a condition of employment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Cameron. Oh, I'm sorry. Were you done, Representative Kremel?
Yes.
Good.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Again, question the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
Yes, ma'am.
He does.
I think my questions to the last bill were on the right line. I hold in my hand two cards that were just handed to me just a little while ago that basically says that if I sign this card, I will allow this organization to represent me in all matters pertaining to wages, hours, and terms in regards to my employment, conditions of employment. And that's what the last bill is about. So my question is, under today's laws, if an employee comes into an employer carrying one of these cards and says, hey, I got this card in the mail, and I don't understand what it's all about, and I'd like to talk to you about it, and I think you should get all of us together after I explain it to him. I think you should get all of us together and talk to us about it. Under today's law, can an employer do that?
Madam Speaker, as far as I know, today an employer can drag an employee in under any conditions and beat him over the head over any subject matter, including those nice cards there, which I hope after today and when these bills become effective, there's a whole lot more handed out. But to answer my question is, your question, I believe they can do that today under today's law.
Follow up, if I may.
Additional question, does the carrier yield?
Yes.
He does.
Can you describe for me what beat over the head means?
Madam Speaker, I'd be happy to. It means they can bring them in and intimidate them, coerce them, threaten them with a worse job, threaten them with poor working conditions, making them their life unbearable when these men and women are out there just trying to make a living to provide for their families. And that's beating them over the head. And I'm standing here right now telling you I oppose every bit of that. And that's why the bill before this and this bill, Madam Speaker, are going to make sure that... by the way, Madam Speaker, there's a very small number of employers that do this kind of thing. I want to get that on the record right now. But that bill before this one are going to make it so people cannot treat workers in that manner. That's what beat over the head is. Thank you for the question.
Follow-up.
Additional question, does the carrier yield?
Yes, ma'am.
He does.
Is there current laws on the books where, or procedures on the books where if an employee feels intimidated or discriminated against for bringing an issue forward, that they can follow those rules and those laws through Department of Labor or BOLI?
Yes, this bill just strengthens that.
To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, maybe I rise today as somebody who believes that we have a lot of employers that do the right thing. And one of those things that we do that's right is we have great communications with our employees. If an employee comes to an employer today and asks them about a ballot measure and says, how is this ballot measure going to affect my family, your business, our business, today the employer can talk to that employee about it. If it comes up, if somebody asks the question in a mandatory meeting that the employer called, that everybody's there, somebody asked the question, today the employer can talk about it and have a dialogue with his employees. A dialogue, not a beating over the head. There are people doing the right thing out there, and we need to remember that as we vote on this.
Further discussion, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Thank you, colleagues. I think the carrier has indicated that there are employers who are perhaps not as responsive as others, and there are probably examples of things that have happened that shouldn't have. And we need to take a scalpel and get rid of that kind of behavior. This is a bludgeon. I believe the language in this law, even, and I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but I even think it has constitutional problems in terms of the broadness of the restriction on speech, particularly political speech. I think that we open a door too wide by this particular bill. I think we have a small problem, and we are taking a huge bat and beating the problem. It's too broad of a language. I opposed it in the committee. I will oppose it again on the floor, and I would urge you to.
Further discussion, Representative Klim.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield? He does.
Now I got to find my question. One moment. Thank you. Does Section 2, lines 22 and 23, where it discusses a prohibition on requiring an employee to, quote, participate in a communication, does this section prohibit an employer from sending a mailer or distributing a flyer with the employer's views on a ballot measure or candidate?
No. Not as long as reading that communication is not a condition of employment.
Follow-up question, Madam Speaker.
Additional question, does the carrier yield?
Yes.
He does.
So if it's a paycheck, would that be considered part of their employment?
Madam Speaker, thank you. Yes, that would be, in my interpretation, a condition of employment. So, Madam Speaker, an employer can still send mailers out. I'm still answering the question. Is that all right? May I continue?
Yes, go ahead.
An employer may send a mailer out to their employees with any kind of opinion, any kind of statement, but not if that mailer or that communication, the reading of that communication, is a condition of employment And I believe a paycheck in your envelope is a condition of employment.
Thank you, Madam Speaker.
Further discussion, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Question of the carrier?
Question of the carrier, does the carrier yield?
Yes, ma'am.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. You're enjoying the question so much, I thought I'd give you one more.
I enjoy questions.
Would it be fair to say, Representative, that the following up on a question asked by the good representative from District 33 related to opening ceremonies, invocations in the House, would it be fair to say that we as legislators are not compelled currently by virtue of our unemployment, by virtue of our employment, to be here for opening ceremonies or invocation currently, since the quorum is not taken until after the opening ceremonies, after the courtesies, much as it would be fair to say that we are not compelled currently, and this bill would extend a similar protection to employees of other businesses, that they would not be compelled to attend any kind of invocations in their places of employment?
I agree with that. I do not, as a representative of this body, feel compelled to listen to any opening ceremonies of any kind. That is a matter of interpretation. Some feel otherwise. But I would agree that I do not believe we are compelled to attend opening ceremonies if we choose not to.
Further discussion, Representative Boquist.
Madam Speaker, I have a question. Well, I think my question is to the Speaker of the House of Representatives.
You wish to ask a question of the Speaker of the House?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Does Representative Berkeley yield to a question? He does. Please state your question.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, to Mr. Speaker. In light of the discussion between House District, the good representative from House District 33 and the carrier, and the good representative from Clackamas County, I'm looking for clarification from the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Is this bill going to end an opening prayer, whether it be from any denomination, and what is your interpretation as the head of this body in regards to, I guess, line 19 and 20, which is the religious matters?
Thank you very much for that question. In this case, it doesn't matter what the Speaker of the House feels. It matters a whole lot what was discussed in committee and what the carrier presents, the analysis that was presented in committee, the underpinnings of the bill. So for me to give you my personal interpretation would be both less informed than the chair of the committee and the carrier, and potentially misleading and not set a consistent record for this body. So on that type of interpretation of what was discussed in committee and the legislative underpinnings that were established, I'm going to defer to the chair.
Follow-up question, Madam Speaker.
Additional question. Is this question addressed to the Speaker or to Representative Merkley or to the carrier?
Representative Merkley.
I'll give you one more as a courtesy.
Thank you, and I apologize, and I would not have raised this whole question had another member raised it. And I'm just looking for an interpretation of the opening ceremony. I mean, we've normally come here and expected to be on the floor for opening ceremony, and until I never even saw it, and I apologize in the bill, the House good representative from District 33 rose, that we were talking about potentially eliminating the opening prayer in this session, and that we didn't have a quorum or didn't take roll till after the opening prayer. I'm slightly confused, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm just looking for clarification, Mr. Speaker.
It sounds like you're asking about clarification, not about the bill, but about the opening ceremony of the House. In that case, it wouldn't be germane to this bill. But if you want to pursue that conversation later, I'll be happy to do so.
That's fine, Madam Speaker. Thank you.
Representative, I think I can offer some clarification, too. In the House rules, it does state that a quorum is not required under the orders of business of opening ceremony, prayer, and or inspirational messages. So I think nor will a call of the House be in order. So I think it's pretty clear in our rules that attendance is not compelled during the prayer. We take roll at the beginning of session only to verify attendance, but attendance is not compelled at that point. Just to call us to order. A further discussion, Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Question of the carrier, please.
Question of the carrier, does the carrier yield?
Yes, ma'am.
He does.
Thank you. As it relates to retirement planning with employees, if an employer calls a retirement planning meeting for which the employees are paid to attend, and in the course of that meeting, discussion of pending legislation is critically important to the retirement planning process, would that be precluded conversation based on this bill?
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Once again, an employee cannot be compelled or forced to attend any meeting as a condition of employment. They can voluntarily sit and listen, but I think it would be in the employer's best interest to avoid in any way, shape, or form trying to force their opinion on an employee about pending legislation on anything during any meeting, if that meeting, once again, is a condition of employment.
Clarification, please.
Clarification?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. I made no statement about forcing an issue whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I'm strictly talking about an employer meeting in which discussion of pending legislation has implications on those employees' retirement plans.
As long as those employees feel like they're not being compelled to stay there and listen to any opinions or any discussion on pending legislation, and they don't feel they're compelled to listen to any discussion on any pending legislation as a condition of employment, I don't see any why that would be any problem.
Follow up, please.
Additional question, does the carrier yield?
Yes.
He does.
Thank you, then, to the carrier. I'm then confused if I comply with current labor law as an employer and I pay the employees for their time at a meeting to discuss retirement planning, am I then breaking the rule as it would be written in this because payment would indicate compelling to be there?
Once again, as long as the employer is just talking about, if they just discuss the details and express facts in the legislation without mandating people to listen to their opinion of the details of that legislation as a condition of employment, I don't see why it would matter. It's kind of like, Madam Speaker, when you're on city council, you can go out with city money and provide information to the voters about a pending measure, but you cannot use your opinion on that if you're using city dollars. It's the same thing here. If they are discussing retirement plans and just the facts, and someone asks a question about pending legislation, I believe the employer and the employees could discuss the fine details of that legislation, the employer could, as long as they do not insert their opinion and compel people to sit and listen to their opinion about that pending legislation as a condition of employment. For example, if they say, my opinion on this, it's bad, and you have to sit here and listen to me why, that would be, or you're fired, or I'm going to give you a worse job, or make your life miserable under my employment, that would be compelling them to listen as a condition of employment. If they're just discussing the specific details of the legislation as just for informative, I don't think that would be a problem. If they just were providing strict information, but that could be easily interpreted, Madam Speaker, so they'd have to be as an opinion So they'd have to be very, very careful with how they phrase those words and frame that language.
I'd like to clarify then, please, Madam Speaker.
A clarifying question.
Thank you.
Do you
yes,
yield?
Ma'am.
He does.
First, I'd like to clarify in my question that I made no statement about someone forcing an issue on someone, nor did I talk about being rude or any other of the terms that you used on those employers. So I want to be careful that there's a lot of great employers out there who would have a purely business meeting who would bring to the table information critical to deal with retirement planning. My further question goes along the lines of, if you hire an outside consulting firm, a professional firm, to come and make a presentation where legislation is discussed and the opinion of the firm is given, does that violate this bill?
Yes, I believe it would.
To the bill.
Madam Speaker, may I clarify my answer? If it's a condition of employment to sit there and listen to that consultant, yes, I believe it would.
To the bill.
Colleagues, in the course of employment and in the course of being an employer, many times, good communication is brought about by putting management and labor together and having good, clear professional communication. This bill simply puts everyone at risk for that type of communication to be available, and I would strongly urge your no vote. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, there's been questions raised about the First Amendment or free speech rights of employers. And as a proponent of free speech, if I thought that this was going to inhibit the free speech or communication rights of employers, I'd be voting no. But I'm not. I'm voting yes, because the way that the bill is intended to work does not prohibit communication. As the AFL-CIO says in their letter, and I'm assuming they're supporting the bill, right, Mr. Schaffler? The bill protects the employer's free speech. Employers can literally have meetings every hour, every day on any topic at all. Think of a hospital, a 24-hour institution with meeting rooms available. Every hour on the hour they can have a meeting. Against unionization, to campaign for a candidate for state office, for or against a ballot measure, they can post flyers, notices, extend personal invitations. They can even hold a raffle to get people interested. They just can't make the meeting mandatory or a condition of employment. This does not inhibit communication. If the employee is uncomfortable listening to political or religious speech, the employee can get up and leave the room without losing his or her job. That's what the bill does, and that's why I'm voting yes, and I urge your aye vote. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
Yes, ma'am.
He does.
Thank you. What is a campaign for legislation? Would you agree that it's, I don't know, whether somebody is going to support or oppose a particular bill or measure?
Madam Speaker, I'd like to ask the good representative to clarify exactly what she's talking about here.
Yes, could you please clarify your question?
Yes, Madam Speaker. Line 16 on page 1. Political
okay.
matters includes political party affiliation, campaigns for legislation,
mm-hmm.
or candidates for political office, et cetera, et cetera.
And the question is?
And so what's a campaign for legislation?
Well, that'd be, for example, Dr. Sinceri couldn't force her employees to listen to what a great representative from District 48 is and why they should support him.
Clarification. That would be for legislation? Campaign
Excuse
for legislation?
Me. I thought you said legislature. Yeah, for example, any measure that's on the ballot. Forgive me. That's an example, Madam Speaker.
Okay. Further question?
For additional question, does the carrier yield?
Yes, ma'am.
He does.
Would it include anything that we're talking about in here?
And once again, Madam Speaker, the employer cannot compel an employee to listen to their opinion, political or religious opinions, as a condition of employment. They can share their ideas if the employee is willing to voluntarily sit there and discuss that them with them. But they cannot compel them to listen as a condition of employment.
Further question, follow-up question?
Additional question, does the carrier yield?
Yes, ma'am.
He does.
I guess I will tell my staff that they cannot, they don't have to sit and listen to my stuff while I'm trying to communicate with them and do my job here. I don't understand. We're members of the public body. The public body is an employer, and our legislative staff, as a course of their job, would kind of need to listen to our opinions on political things, wouldn't they?
My administrator has told me that our staff here in this building are exempt from the discussions we have here, and they would not be considered compelled to listen to our opinions, although I have to admit they are.
Another question.
Additional question, does the carrier yield?
Yes, ma'am.
He does.
First of all, I don't see an exemption. However, I'm wondering also about advocacy commissions and advocacy committees, task forces on the state, local, county, city level, and the staff that would be required to type up minutes or mail these communications. Are they then not required to do their job?
Madam Speaker, I do not believe, and I'm confident that our legislative staff will still be, we will still be able to ask them and direct them to do those activities.
Clarification.
Yes.
I wasn't talking. I moved on past legislative staff now to advocacy commissions, government-paid staff to type up minutes for these meetings, task forces on workplace harassment, for instance. Things like that, where you've got staff that's having to deal with whatever communications that are probably pretty political in nature are taking place as a condition of their job, because that is their job. I don't see an exemption for that. Is there one?
Madam Speaker, if it's your job as a legislative staff or as governmental staff to type minutes of a meeting up where opinions are expressed, then you would not be compelled to sit and listen to someone's opinions as a condition of employment. You would just simply be doing your job.
Clarification?
Madam Chair, I would like some clarification, too. Thank you very much. Yes.
Okay, maybe I'll clarify. If it's your job to take minutes at a meeting where political communication and campaigns possibly for legislation are occurring, such as would happen at advocacy commissions, advocacy committees, task forces, and the like on the state, you know, every level of government, and your job is to sit there and listen and take minutes or type up minutes or be support staff, is there an exemption in place for that?
Madam Speaker, you willingly and voluntarily do that. Once again, if an employer invites you to a meeting, you can go listen. If it's your job and you're doing that job and that's your job description, you voluntarily do it. That is not forcing your opinion on anyone. What line is it?
What?
That's the layman's answer. According to the bill, Representative, we do not prohibit communications of information about religious or political matters that the employer is required by law to communicate, but only to the extent of the legal requirement. I hope that clarifies it.
Okay, so another question, please.
Madam Speaker, I will yield one more question.
Additional question, final question. Does the carrier yield? He does.
Thank you for your patience.
You're welcome.
If there's a signing company and they happen to do political signs and part of the person's job is to run those through the machine, is that considered political communications that would be banned under this bill?
I do not believe so, no. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. My good friend and representative from Happy Valley, I didn't plan to ask any questions, but when we started down this path with the representative from House District 33, you caught my interest, so I have a question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier, does the carrier yield?
Yes.
He does.
Some previous questions have been raised about this body, the legislative body, and whether or not we as members can be compelled, or staff, chief clerk and her staff in this case. And your answer was no, they're exempted, and we're still trying to find out why that's the case, because this bill is not very clear on that.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. You know, we're a really self-absorbed bunch. This bill is not about the legislature, Madam Speaker, and I mean that dead seriously. This is not about us. Now, we are not compelled under the law to attend opening ceremonies, period. And neither are any of the staff. If they do not want to participate in any religious opening ceremony, they do not have to. With all due respect to my good friend from the Central Oregon.
Well, and I follow up.
Additional question, does the carrier yield? And let me mention to the members that it is not in order to make any comments before asking a question.
Thank you.
Does the carrier yield?
Yes, ma'am.
He does.
So this bill would only apply to employers, and this is the key, if I understand this correctly, page 1, lines 9 through 11. The only employers would be those engaged in business, private sector, I'm presuming is what that means, or a public body as defined at ORS 174-109, and that, because of that definition, would exclude the executive department, the legislative department, the judicial department, local government, local service districts, etc., because those are all separate sections in the ORS. Is that correct?
Yeah. Madam Speaker, I think I can just solve this for a lot of these questions. It says right in here that it doesn't prohibit conversations of politics for political organizations, political parties, other organizations, if this is a substantial part of their job, and if they're actively involved in political activities. So, therefore, we're exempt in this building.
To the bill?
To the bill.
And I want to thank my friend, again, the representative from Happy Valley, for taking the ad hoc questions. Colleagues, the reason I felt compelled to step up and ask these questions is because, to me, I think it's incumbent on us to make sure we understand what these bills are that we're passing. And if it's not clear as to exactly what the group of employers is or what the group of employees are that are covered by this bill, then I would suggest that we might want to reconsider the bill so we really, in fact, understand what it is that we're doing. And thank you, Madam Speaker. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Colleagues, what this bill is really about is something that happened to me back in the early 70s when I worked for the great state of Oregon. And I worked for the Oregon State Police. And some of us thought we should have a union. We thought we should have benefits. We thought we should have overtime pay. And I had to sit and listen and be intimidated and threatened. The brass went back to my office and had my friends come tell me, my colleagues come tell me, one more word about overtime out of that no good SOB from St. Helens and he's being shipped to Eastern Oregon. Those are the kind of things that this is addressing. I shouldn't have had to sit there and listen to it, and you might be surprised to know that I didn't sit and listen to it, and I watched a fairly promising career go right down the drain, and I ended up having a great career at the City of Portland Police where we did have some rights. But that's what this is about. I shouldn't have to listen, and neither should anybody else, have to listen to somebody badger them, trying to force them to not vote for a union or to vote for a union either way. That's the kind of thing that this is aimed for. I shouldn't have to go in, and if I don't want to, have to listen to somebody, a boss say, we're going to all pray together. I might not find that offensive, and I might be glad to stay there. But if I did find it offensive for any reason whatsoever, I should be able to get up and say no thank you and I leave. That's what this is about. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Richardson.
Madam Speaker, colleagues, in response to Representative from Beaverton and Aloha, while that may be the intention, we have to anticipate unintended consequences. In in the 03 session, there were 8 bills that we passed, but the session went so long that they came back and had to have fix-it legislation passed in the same session because of unintended consequences. And so while that may be the intention, we still must live within the four corners of this document. And so this is actually the OB bill, because he is required to be here during prayers and during discussions on political issues. And that isn't fair, because his employment requires him to be here. And so what I'm really saying, of course, is that if the bill has provisions that are not doing what it's intended to do, then we should fix the bill now and not pass it through when it's going to cause problems that it wasn't intended to cause. And so we should say no on the bill. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Patty Smith. Further discussion, Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Madam
and
Speaker.
Representative Greenlick, I'm recognizing you for the second time because no one else is in the queue.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I would like to clarify my position that I stated before. And in no way am I proposing that we not have opening ceremonies in the legislative session. But what I am proposing is, let me read Section 2 of Article 1 of the Bill of Rights. And it says, all men shall be secure in the natural right to worship Almighty God according to the dictates of their own conscience. All I'm asking, and all I've asked through my three sessions here, is that we move the roll call till after the opening ceremony. The argument is that the verification of quorum comes after the opening ceremony, but that's not a public event. The public event, if my constituents are watching, and they're watching on television, they see the roll call, and Greenlick's not here. I feel compelled by my employment, by my employers who are in fact my constituents, to be here when the roll call is called, and I feel embarrassed when it's not. And as you notice, I'm usually not here when the roll call. My problem would be solved. I don't care if the worship is Wicca. I don't care if it's Jewish. I don't care if it's Catholic. I don't care if it's evangelical. I just want a right to not come here for it and to not feel that I'm shirking in my duty. I think we ought to have an opening ceremony. I think it's in the great tradition of the body. I have no problem with it, and I like the fact that it's mixed. All I want is the roll call after the opening ceremony. Thank you, Madam Speaker.
Seeing no one further in the queue, Representative Schaffler, do you wish to close?
Yeah, Madam Speaker, thank you. You know, this is really simple. It's not complicated. All it we're saying is that an employer cannot compel an employee to attend a meeting or read any communication that expresses their political or religious opinions, and that they have to read or attend as a condition of employment. As it's already been stated, the vast majority of employers aren't going to have any problem with that. And you know what? The bludgeon that my friend spoke about, that's why we're here, because people don't do the right thing. If everyone did the right thing, we wouldn't even need a legislature. Everybody would drive safely and on the right side of the road. No one would be a thief or a bum or deadbeat. We wouldn't even need laws. But you know what? Because people aren't that way, that's why we're here. Let me see here if I got something else to say. Well, that's about it, Madam Speaker. It's a good bill. I urge your vote. Thanks. Call the House now. I respectfully request call the House.
Representative Schaffler asks for a call of the House. He is joined by Representatives Barnhart, Representative Gelster, Representative David Edwards, Representative John Dallum, and Representative George Gilman. Doorkeepers will bar the doors. The Sergeant-at-Arms will attend, and the clerk will call the roll.
Barker, Barnhart, Berger, Beyer, Bonamici, Boone, Boquist, Boquist-Bruin, Buckley, Burley, Burley-Butler, Cameron, Cannon, Clem, Cowan, Dallum, Dingfelder, Chris Edwards, David Edwards, Esquivel, Flores, Flores-Galizio, Garrard, Gilzer, Gilliam, Gilman, Gerard, Greenlick, Hannah, Holvey, Hunt, Jensen, Comp, Kotek, Krieger, Crummel, Lim, McPherson, Maurer, Minnis, Morgan, Nathanson, Nelson, Nolan, Olson, Reed, Richardson, Riley, Roblin, Rosenbaum, Rosenbaum-Schaffler, Scott, Shields, Greg Smith, Patty Smith, Thatcher, Tomei, Wisnet, Witt, Mr. Speaker, not answering, Boquist, Burley, Flores, Mr. Speaker, excused, not subject to the call, Krieger, Scott.
All members are present. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Gilliam, how do you vote? Votes no. Representative Esquivel, how do you vote? Votes no. Representative Flores, how do you vote? Votes no. Representative Crummel, how do you vote? Votes no. Representative Jensen, how do you vote? Votes no. Representative Schaffler, how do you vote? Votes aye. House Bill 2893, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Final reading, memorials, and resolutions. The Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and that House Joint Memorial 7 be carried over to its proper place on the Monday, April 23, 2007 calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Bills, reports, and other business lying on the table. First reading of Senate bills.
Senate Bill 5511 related to financial administration, employment relations, board of appropriate money, and declaring emergency. Senate Bill 5512 related to financial administration, state board, Department of Energy, appropriate money, and declaring emergency. Senate Bill 5527 related to financial administration of the Board of Medical Examiners, and declaring emergency. Senate Bill 5534 related to financial administration of Psychiatric Security Review Board, appropriate money, and declaring emergency. Senate Bill 5541 related to financial administration of the Department of Veterans Affairs, appropriate money, and declaring emergency. Senate Bill 5545 related to financial administration, appropriate money, and declaring emergency. Senate Bill 39 related to tax compliance, prescribing an effective date. Senate Bill 77 related to elections, and declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 303 relating to garnishments. Senate Bill 379 relating to children and declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 554 relating to public records. Senate Bill 590 relating to criminal impersonation. Senate Bill 748 relating to authorization to practice public accountancy. Senate Bill 892 relating to hunting and declaring an emergency.
Bills read first time are passed to the Speaker's desk for referral. Second reading of Senate bills. Third reading of Senate bills. The Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and that the bills remaining on today's third reading of Senate bills be carried over to their proper place on tomorrow's third reading calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Other business of the House? Other business of the Senate? Orders of the day have been completed. Announcements. Representative Dingfelder?
Thank you, Madam Speaker. The House Energy and Environment Committee will convene at 6:45 this evening in Hearing Room C.
Further announcements? Remonstrances? Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Governor Kulongoski has declared this week Shaken Baby Syndrome Awareness Week. Shaken baby syndrome is a medically serious and often fatal result of violent shaking of children from birth through age 3. Vigorous shaking of an infant or child can result in serious damage, including bleeding inside of the head that causes irreversible brain damage, blindness, cerebral palsy, hearing loss, spinal cord injury, seizures, learning disabilities, and death. While doctors have long recognized that shaking an infant can cause serious injury, many adults remain unaware of how dangerous this practice can be, leading to the injury of many infants. It is estimated that an average of 300 children will die, and 600 to 1,200 more children will be injured, with many cases resulting in severe and permanent disabilities. Shaken baby syndrome is recognized as the leading cause of death to children as a result of abuse. Oregon suffers significant economic loss due to the medical cost of treating this syndrome and the cost of rehabilitation services to surviving infants. A significant portion of these costs are paid for by the state of Oregon's Medicaid program. The Congress of the United States and several states, including California and Washington, have undertaken to recognize the third week of April as Shaken Baby Syndrome Awareness Week, which is why Governor Kulongoski has declared the same here in Oregon. So this is Shaken Baby Awareness Week, and if we can remind those who have infants, it is never okay to shake a baby. Thank you.
Further remonstrances, Representative Kremel.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Actually, I guess this should have been an announcement, but that's okay. I'll do it now. On Monday, April 23rd, I would just like to let everybody know it's going to be Charter Schools Day here at the Capitol. We will have, I don't know yet how many, but we're going to have quite a few students and parents and teachers from charter schools in the building. If you see them, when you see them, please be kind to them. Welcome them to the Capitol, and they may swing by your offices and want to say hi. Thank you, Madam Speaker.
For the remonstrances, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Colleagues, given the massacre at Virginia Tech Monday, legislatures and legislators all over the country are looking for ways to make our campuses safer. And you would think that would be the case here in Oregon. The answer to that rhetorical statement is no, it isn't. I thought we were going to have that discussion this week. I thought we were going to have at least an opportunity to debate of whether this was something we should be looking at. But that is not the case either. About a week and a half ago, an individual came to me and started talking to me about campus security. And I was excited to see that it was going to be scheduled for a hearing. But yesterday afternoon, especially in light of what happened Monday, yesterday afternoon it was on the schedule and then it wasn't on the schedule. And I've alerted the chair that I was going to be making these comments, so I don't think he's going to strike me. As I understand from the sponsors of that bill, Oregon is one of two states that does not allow for campus police to be armed in our 7 public universities. With the exception of 2 schools, Oregon State University, which contracts with the Oregon State Police, and the University of Oregon, which contracts with the Eugene Police Department. It seems to me the time has come that we should allow our college campuses to have the highest level of security possible, especially when some of them have populations larger than some small towns, and not just because of what happened at Virginia Tech, but because it is the right thing to do. Thank you, Madam Speaker.
For the remonstrances, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. And since Representative Carmel broke the sequence of things, I won't ask to return to announcements and just go ahead and make my remonstrance as an announcement. And that's to, if the body hasn't heard, former Representative Vic Backlund had surgery today, and it was successful for carotid arteries, I think. And so his daughter works for me. If you want any kind of updates on it, why, you might stop by and see her.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. We certainly wish him all the best. Further remonstrances? Adjournment, Representative Jensen, 10 a.m. Thursday, April 19th, 2007.
Madam Speaker, I move that the House stand adjourned until 10 a.m. Thursday, April 19th, 2007.
Representative Jensen moves the House adjourn until 10 a.m. Thursday, April 19th, 2007. Without objection, the House is adjourned.